This Week in Nuclear, Episode 80 for November 22nd, 2009. Welcome to the show. I'm John Wheeler, your host, and you're listening to This Week in Nuclear, a podcast focusing on the peaceful uses of nuclear energy and how nuclear energy will make our world cleaner, safer, and less reliant on fossil fuels. I've just come to expect traditional news sources to be irresponsible in the way they report nuclear energy news. It seems like hardly a week goes by without some misinformation or anti-nuclear sensationalism on the television, radio, or in the newspapers. Just 3 or 4 years ago, these traditional news sources used to have a virtual monopoly, and the news cycle was measured in hours or even days. Now, with blogs and the social media like Twitter and Facebook, news spreads in seconds and in minutes, and the news monopolies have vanished. What's even more important, though, is communities of experts are able to hold the media accountable for poor reporting and in some cases can force them to change their stories. This morning was just such an example. About 3 weeks ago, Unit 1 at the Three Mile Island nuclear plant set a new world record with their 705-day uninterrupted run. This means they produced electricity every day for 705 consecutive days. That's an amazing feat. And it's a testament of how they're maintaining and operating their plant safely and reliably. At the end of their record run, they began a maintenance and refueling outage that's still underway. About 4 p.m. yesterday afternoon, a radiation monitor inside their containment alarmed, and they stopped work to investigate. They discovered some tiny radioactive particles on surfaces in the affected area, probably caused by grinding on metal pipes of contaminated systems. A few workers had some of the radioactive particles on their protective clothing and skin and had to be cleaned. Early this morning, the Harrisburg, Pennsylvania ABC News Channel carried a headline that said, "Radiation Leak at Three Mile Island Nuclear Plant," in large, bold letters on their website. The article stated that there had been a radiation leak in the plant and more than 100 workers had to be decontaminated. I first learned about this from April Shilp, who I follow on Twitter. April is a communications specialist in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. Let me see if I can get April on the phone and we can talk about it.
April Shilp.
April, good morning. It's John Wheeler.
Hi, the famous John Wheeler.
Well, I wouldn't go that far. It's good to talk
to you. You're famous to me.
Well, you're famous to me. I've been following you on Twitter for a while. You got some
great
information.
Cool. Thanks. So do you.
Hey, this is a really kind of a funny story as it's evolved.
I know, isn't it?
From a social media standpoint. I got up this morning. I actually slept in for a change. I got up about 9 o'clock and I got on the computer and was kind of reading my tweets and I saw your tweet about the story at Three Mile Island and how they were really mischaracterizing what happened. So why don't you tell me about how you found out about it and what happened?
Well, I should give you like full disclosure here. I used to work for Exelon in communications.
Okay.
So, and I live about, 20 miles from TMI.
Uh-huh.
So I was watching the local news last night after the college football game, and they led with this story out in front of, with the cooling towers in the background and the whole bit. And their, Chiron and everything on the news on ABC 27, which is the local ABC affiliate, was that, there was a radiation leak at TMI.
Mm-hmm.
And they interviewed a corporate spokesperson, just who said things about not dangerous levels, whatever. But clearly they were not, they were going for the sensationalism, in my opinion, because
Sure. That's
not what happened. It's clearly not what happened. You and I know that there were all kinds of official things that would have happened
had there been
an actual leak. So knowing that, it really made me mad because, I thought they were being irresponsible and playing with this whole radiation leak. And then this morning I got up and they're still reporting that and still using that language. And then CNN's picking it up and AP and stuff like that. So mainly thinking because I'm getting local people contacting me who are also in my Twitterverse, you know, saying, what's going on at TMI, you know, it sounds terrible. And they, you know, some of them know me and know that I have nuclear background, and others just, you know, wonder what I know and saw my tweet. So, I mean, I know exactly what happened. They're doing two steam generator replacements yesterday. I mean, they've been doing this for a while, but it appears that what actually happened, Exelon has a press release out, and it's been out there too. Ironically, nobody's, you know, picking up on what's in that.
On what really happened,
On what really happened, which is an airborne contamination event.
Right.
So the people were affected, and the real, you know, the real reason this is an issue is because, as I know you're familiar with all of this, there was an area set aside to be a clean area near the where they were doing the cutting of the pipes that led to the steam generators to remove the old one and put the new one in. And obviously, there were people in this clean area who were not in anti-seize. So that's why there was anybody even affected. Clearly, people who were in the proper contamination gear would not have been affected at all. It just became airborne, and so, you know, you pretty much got it right when your best guess came out.
So
that's what has happened.
So for people who don't know what anti-seize are, they're really coveralls, your cloth coveralls that cover your arm, your full body, and you wear a hat.
Your whole body, and you wear something, hood and gloves and booties and everything. Yeah. And usually you have safety goggles on during that period too, so most of your face would be covered as well.
Right.
But unfortunately, a large number of people, you know, were affected by this.
Go ahead.
Go ahead. They had to check people, obviously. So that's part of it too, is of course the utility's trying to be really careful that they don't leave anybody out. And so they let people go home last night once they cleared the monitors, essentially.
They didn't send them. My guess is, and I haven't spoken to the plant, I've managed activities like this before in the past.
Mm-hmm.
And when you have an event like this, you have a lot of workers who are, you know, working in that area, and now you've got to close the area down to investigate it and get it all cleaned up so that they can go back to work. And it doesn't make sense to keep them all standing around. And so you send them home.
Exactly. Exactly.
And as you indicated, the conservative thing to do when something like this happens is stop work, get everybody out of the area, frisk everybody out with radiation detectors to make sure nobody has any radioactive particles on their skin.
Right.
And it sounds like there were a few people who did, and that they were washed, probably with regular soap and water, and it comes off.
And you see how low the levels are that are being reported.
The
other thing too.
Somebody got, you know, in the new. I read the New York newspaper said that one worker had 16 millirem of exposure. Well, that's a normal amount of exposure for somebody working on a steam generator during an outage. That's a very, very, very low number.
It's actually really low. Exactly. to be working around steam generators at all.
I've done routine inspections where I wasn't even touching the equipment and received more dose than that, you know, in 20 or 30 minutes. That's a minute amount of radiation when you are working in that kind of an environment.
I agree. And that's the problem is I think that, first of all, it's a TMI. So, you know, that's part of the issue. I think there was a lot of exposure from the traditional media with the steam generator moving locally, you know, from where it was brought to port to TMI. It had to make a month-long journey down, you know, and they had to close roads and build bridges and move power lines and all kinds of stuff. So that was very public.
Right.
And of course, it's TMI. So if anything happens, you know, at TMI, it's probably going to have a little bit more exposure than bad choice of words, but a little bit more interest from the media than other plants would. So, I understand why they wanted to lead with that, but was very disappointed, especially in the web story, because when I saw it on TV, I was like, okay, well, how many people are up at, you know, 1 o'clock in the morning, East Coast time, watching this local channel? You know, it's probably okay. They'll probably have it all fixed in the morning. But the web story was still up this morning, and it led with radiation leak, and then everybody just started to pick it up. And
well, the web story this morning, when I first, you know, when I first saw it, I wish I'd have taken a screenshot. Because it said,
Did they fix it? I haven't seen it recently.
Yeah, they changed it. Right, like I said, around 9:30 this morning when I first saw it, it's big bold letters: radiation leak at 3 Mile and nuclear plant. And then in the news story, it said that 150 workers were contaminated. 15 or 20 minutes later, I went back to the story and they had changed the headline.
Yeah.
And now the headline says, let me see what it says now. It says radiation contained inside 3 Mile Island.
Oh, thank God. Well, that's the thing. I mean, and the reporter who was there last night was a reporter on the scene this morning on TV, you know, and so I think she was probably there all night, and, you know, and she said some of those things, but the you know, none of the stories were that. And of course, when the big blazing headline across the screen when she's standing there is, you know, radiation leak at TMI.
Right.
You know, nobody, and of course, as you know, the general public does not understand the difference between, you know, radiation and contamination.
Right.
And how, you know, you can't get contaminated standing across the street 1.5 miles away from the island. So,
Well, they use other things like, I'm just reading one line here. I agree with you. You know, people are confused about what contamination means. And what it means really is just you have radioactive material in a place where you don't expect to have it.
Right.
And so you need to control contact
with yourself. And it's not necessary. Yeah. That's the best way to say it. Of course, you know, it would be nice if somebody was actually, that's what I would have, had I had been handling this crisis from a communication standpoint, I would have led with, before I tell you anything, let me explain very clearly to you the difference between what you think of as radiation, a black plume of poison heading your way, you know, and what this event is. It's totally different. And I would have said something about it only affected workers. And, you know, to say that 150 people, they may have monitored 150 people because they were being incredibly conservative, but, you know, they obviously, you know, that doesn't mean that those 150 people were contaminated. So
when they say monitored for exposure, they mean that they, you know, used a monitor to see if they had any on them. And some of the workers, they may have done what they call whole body counts, where they check to see if they inhaled any of the particles.
And they did whole body counts on some of them. And I think that's where you get the lower number of people.
Mm-hmm.
That you've probably read in some of the accounts have said something like, you know, a lower number of people were given whole body counts, and I'm assuming those were the people that they could identify being in the specific area. So
one of the things that catches my eye about the statement that 151 workers were monitored for exposure, well, in fact, every single worker in the plant is monitored for exposure.
I know. Every time they walk out, you're right.
So it's not
every
like
single, and whenever they're inside a radioactive area or whatever. Yeah, exactly.
You know, they always wear monitors every day that they work in a radiation area. They're monitored every second of every day that they're in the plant working. You know, just so to say that, you know, these 150 workers were monitored really means nothing.
Yeah, exactly.
So But again, the public doesn't know that, and so they're really, as you said, they're going for the sensationalism.
Right.
And it's really disappointing because I really think, you know, that it affects their credibility.
Mm-hmm.
It will affect
I agree. I mean, for us, I think it does. I just don't think that people are quite there yet where they, although I do think that people will believe something they hear from somebody they follow on Twitter or, you know, read their blogs regularly, they'll believe that over traditional mainstream media. I do think that's a much more, just a much more credible channel in the sense, you know, it can go both ways, right? Because if you have misinformation in social media, it can certainly hurt you a lot worse than, you know, misinformation in traditional media, but, because it's live time, go ahead.
One of the things analogies that I make is the news cycle. It, you know, even 3 years ago, the traditional media sources had a monopoly. But now that's not true. Blogs, podcasts, you know, social media like Facebook and Twitter are avenues for people on the scene or subject matter experts to make a case.
Exactly.
And with the news cycle now, you know, again, news cycle 3 or 4 years ago was hours or even days. A story would happen, and it, you know, you maybe didn't see it until the next day in the newspaper or at the, you know, the next evening news or morning news segment.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Now the news cycle is seconds or minutes when something happens. And it really gives us an opportunity to provide instantaneous feedback and get out in front of some of this stuff. Now, it's unfortunate that this one happened, you know, at, you know, 8 or 9 o'clock on a Saturday night, and we weren't able to get out in front of it before they started running these sensationalist headlines.
Right, exactly. Well, and I think that's, you know, to go to a different problem. I think I would like to see the utilities themselves engaged much more in social media, you know, their own communications channel, their own SMEs, because this event happened at 4:30 in the afternoon yesterday.
Yeah.
And, you know, the news crew probably showed up at 9:30. And, you know, I'm pretty sure the news crew was not, well, I think they were educated about it, but not from official sources when they decided it was a story. So,
well, they may have interviewed people coming out of the plant.
Yep.
Who were sent home.
I think people who left the plant were a little freaked out. I mean, the other thing that you probably understand as well is that this kind of construction work, even though it is, you know, people are fully qualified to operate in this area, it's not something that most of these people do, you know, even though they're experts at doing the replacement, they're not full-time nuclear employees, if that makes sense.
Yeah, they work in other kinds of plants, too. They may work in cogen plants, coal plants, et cetera. And they're here to do the heavy construction, welding, pipe fitting, et cetera. And so
they might be a little bit more weirded out by something that they don't completely understand, and leave site and just, you know, tell somebody that might be.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about how it could have gone had some of the plant folks or the industry or the NRC taken advantage of the social media.
Well, and that's what I would really, you know, like to see happen more. I think that they could have gotten out in front of it immediately. I know from, you know, being in communications in the nuclear industry that, you know, you do want to reach out as soon as there's an event. But there is some hesitation, and, you know, some of it comes from TMI in 79, but there is some hesitation to get out there too early and to ensure that other stakeholders, I mean, I'm talking now from the utility standpoint, to ensure that other stakeholders get the same message that, you know, they're telling the public. And as you know, when you're talking to two different audiences, sometimes, you know, one of them has to be sacrificed for the sake of the other.
Right. You're not going to send out a tweet or put it on your company's Facebook page before you have an opportunity to brief the NRC resident inspectors.
Exactly.
Your CEO, you know, perhaps any local elected officials. You know, so you need to go through those channels first, and sometimes they're, you know, on a Saturday afternoon, they may not be readily available.
It can take some time to do that, yes. Certainly not 5 hours, but it takes some time to do that. And, you know, and so what often comes out of that is an awful lot of time to, you know, overthink, I think, the message when it's really quite simple. You know, you can, it's not anything that anybody should necessarily, in this case, if your regulations say that no off-site notification is required, you know, that doesn't mean that you stop there. It doesn't mean that it's not still needed, you know, for the public standpoint. It means that from a regulatory standpoint, you're good. So, I think I understand those challenges, but.
Yeah, I'm curious. I'm going to look and see if Exelon has a Twitter account.
I don't believe they do. Yeah. They do, but I think it's, well, you'll have to check that out.
Yeah. I'll check. I mean, I'm going to go look and see, you know, the large nuclear utilities, how many of them have Twitter accounts. It'll be interesting to see if any of them are using that source to get information out. So,
I think
I'll do
Duke.
That offline.
Yeah. I will tell you that my understanding is, because I look into this frequently, mm-hmm. Duke Energy is the only one I can think of that does. Now, I don't know that they've had any occasion to use it, you know, in that way.
Yeah.
But, you know, what I'd like to see is, what I'd like to see are people, you know, certainly I'd like to see them engage. If they're not going to do it themselves, then let's engage people like you from the beginning, just like your any other media outlet, you know? Why are we not getting in touch with you and Dan Yerman and Rod?
Adams.
What's Rod's name?
Rod
Adams. Yeah. Why isn't everybody talking to you guys like just like you would? Because you can get the word out there through your own channels if it's not.
Right. Well, you know that's what Ariba's doing. You know, Ariba now has their blog. They have twice a month, every other Friday, they have a blogger conference call where they share what they're doing.
Oh, do they really?
Yeah. Yeah, so
that's cool.
The Ariba blog, they're on Twitter. They've got a Twitter feed, so they're sending out information. So they're really, I think, the most progressive of the large companies in the nuclear industry when it comes to social media. They get it. They understand it, and they are actively engaging the people who can help them.
Right.
You know, so that's it. You know, make a great point. Why, you know, sending out a press release is sure, you got to do that, but in today's age, that's not enough.
You know, right.
So another option might have been to, you know, if you had a Twitter feed, then people in the nuclear business would be following that feed, and you could have announced, hey, we're going to do a conference call for bloggers and nuclear bloggers and podcasters at midnight.
Right.
And if you're available, you know, by that time we've had enough time to communicate with our stakeholders. We know we've probably finished the investigation. We know what happened. We know the scope of what occurred. Let's have a conference call with the pro-nuclear blog and podcast community, and let them get in on the story and help, let them help us spread what really happened. So I think they might be surprised with the positive
results. I agree.
Yeah.
I agree. Yeah. I was aware. I just noticed that a couple days ago that Ariba was following me, and that's the first that I even knew that they had a Twitter.
Yeah.
I guess it's relatively new.
I know they had
like their transport, Ariba transport, because when they were delivering the TMI generators, I know they had one, and I was following them too, because they had some cool pictures that they were putting up online, and it was pretty neat. But yeah, I think that's the way to do it. I understand how conservative the utilities feel they need to be, but you know, these are not enemies here. I mean, there's a lot of people who could help them, and you know, traditional media, the risk that you take with limiting yourself to traditional media is that they are fighting for their lives now.
Yeah.
So the stories are potentially, especially with a contentious topic like nuclear power, you know, the stories are potentially going to get even more and more sensational to try to get people, you know, to try to get an
audience. Right. And the fact that they were wrong.
Yeah.
Really, they still haven't published a retraction.
I know. Isn't it amazing? And they are unlikely to do so.
Right.
You know, what's in it for them by doing that?
Exactly.
You know, they've got people whining about them now. But
I'll give you an interesting tidbit here. Is when I saw the article on the ABC 27 News website, I attempted to register so that I could post a comment. And I went through the registration process, and it got to the point where it said, okay, you're going to get an email with a link that you can click to activate your new account. It never came.
Oh, you're kidding me.
No. So I was ready to post. I had a quick post up to make the post, and it never it never came in my inbox. So I still have not been able to post a comment. Now I'm looking here. There are four people who have commented. And let's see. Taking a quick look. One of them is spam.
Oh, geez. Hey, how come they could get through and you couldn't?
Yeah. That's too funny. So I'll try again later, so we can continue to try to make sure that they're held accountable for their irresponsible reporting.
Well, for your information, I have heard from other buddies that the NRC is actually going to be doing a media op at 2 o'clock.
Okay.
So, I mean, I don't know how interested you are in it, and I'm sure there's stuff on their website. It's probably an open, call-in kind of thing.
Yeah, that's only in a few minutes. I'll have to see if they're going to have anything. If it'll be open to, like, a conference call or something. So.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, like, I think they're actually being the NRC is being pretty good about, also being out there today. I don't think they were anywhere to be seen last night when it started. But it seems like what I've read in other media, they have, their A person on it,
right.
Diane Scrunchie in Region 1. So I'm sure they're probably just as concerned. I think the biggest problem is going to be a local one because I've read some quotes about how, the Pennsylvania Emergency Management Association feel slighted because they didn't get notified until somebody else called them or whatever. And
why they tend to go slowly, because they are trying to make sure they get all the stakeholders involved. But at the same token, they missed an opportunity here to get the truth out before news outlets like CNN picked it up and put it on the national news. So now they're going to be doing damage control.
Yep.
Where
unfortunately,
had they been a little more proactive, they could have maybe limited some of that.
So. And I'm with you because I don't think it's all a news release. I mean, I understand why you need to do that, but I don't think it's all that, because if you put that out, you still don't control the message. You control what's on the piece of paper, so you can make the NRC happy that you released it at a certain point in time and you had all the technical accuracy in it. But there's no guarantee that they're not going to then start calling, other people and getting other quotes or, running with total misinformation that's not in there. So, so I agree. I would love to see more proactivity and more actual, engagement with sources other than the traditional media from this kind of stuff. And believe me, I've been through these things a number of times with Exxon, with another company, being the lead, you're the lead if you're the communications person on this stuff, and it doesn't take that long. You can have everybody notified, in a half an hour, and it doesn't matter. It's a 24/7 business, so.
Yeah.
So I'd like to see them, think about a wider audience of people to contact while they're doing their either formal or informal notifications.
Mm-hmm. Well, I agree. Well, hey, thanks for taking a few minutes to talk to me this morning. This has been really fascinating to watch it evolve and unfold, and I will...
I'm glad I gave you something fun to do on Sunday.
Yeah, it was interesting, very thought-provoking to watch it unfold and how the new media and the social media is changing how information gets out to the public.
Yeah. So. Yeah, that's my favorite thing. So thanks for the great work you're doing.
Well, thank you. I'm going to put a link to your Twitter feed on the show notes for this episode of This Week in Nuclear, and anybody out there who wants to follow you will be able to do so. So thank you, April.
Great. Thank you, John.
Keep up the good work, too.
All right.
All right. Have a great afternoon.
Thanks very much for the call.
Yeah.
You
too.
Bye-bye.
I hope you enjoyed this episode of This Week in Nuclear podcast. Please stop by the website at thisweekinnuclear.com, where you can find links to the news story we spoke about in today's episode. There's also a link to April's Twitter feed, so you can follow April Schlipp and get nuclear energy news and social media news. So until next time, this is John Wheeler with This Week in Nuclear. Have a great day.